Hello and welcome to Comics Corner. I am your host, Connor, joined again by Harry.
We're so back.
Yeah, we had a universe-wide reboot. We had a costume change, the whole thing. I don't remember most of my history.
Somebody cut my hair.
Yeah, and speaking of not understanding continuity, Grant Morrison's Animal Man, we decided to come back with a bang. Mainly because, as well, we wanted to follow this on, hopefully, with Crisis on Infinite Earths and Legends. Mm. So you can understand exactly what happened to comics in the 80s leading up to when Watchmen ruin everything. But I'm getting ahead.
Well, this was post-Watchmen, wasn't it? And might have been, from what you've been discussing before we began recording this, it might have been a commentary on Watchmen, which is giving it some positive credit, which I will not be giving it.
Right, okay, so let's go into this, because I said to you before this is the Omnibus Edition for our audio listeners. This was the 2022 reprint. Very famous story. It was the thing that put Grant Morrison on the map as part of his... He moved over to the US in order to do this as part of the British invasion. And it's very famous for being what most people consider to be a metatextual triumph. And I read it, and I was very disappointed. So I said to you, we need to do this episode first so I can decide whether or not I need to sell this thing. What were your thoughts?
First of all, I'd like to clarify a few things. You said not understanding continuity then brought us over to Animal Man and Grant Morrison. So obviously this was post-Crisis on Infinite Earths, which was a massive reboot of the entire DC universe. I think the first time they had formally done that. Clearly, there had been plenty of retcons in the past, especially during the Silver Age and going into the Bronze Age. But this was the first time that DC had consciously said, here is a story which says everything is reset, we're changing everything. So you're a continuity artist. Grant Morrison, from what I understood, especially having read his Batman run, is somewhat of a continuity artist himself, because the whole purpose of his Batman run, from what I saw, was... Yes, it told a few compelling stories in it, but mostly was not actually to tell an overarching compelling story, but was instead to say, let's make all of these things that don't fit into the Batman universe make sense in some way. He was trying to flatten out that continuity and even it out for everybody as a kind of primer for people going into Batman. So what is it that he gets wrong with the continuity in this story?
Well, it's not necessarily that Morrison gets wrong. It's okay. More so that he's responding to the fact that Crisis on Infinite Earths, which was released as the 50th anniversary event for DC as well, didn't quite smooth over all of the cracks that it intended to do. A great example of this is Zero Hour, something that we mentioned in our third episode on 90s Comics and Kingdom Come, came in after Crisis and called itself a Crisis in Time, because even though all of the multiverses in Crisis on Infinite Earths had been consolidated into one universe, one character per label, lots of the characters still had their pre-Crisis continuity folded into their post-Crisis timeline. And so something like Hawkman had about five origins. He was a reincarnated Egyptian prince. He was from the planet Thanagar. He was some archaeologist called Carter Hall. And nobody knew exactly who he was. And so it just got very confusing. And Morrison is actually pointing out in Animal Man that lots of these pre-Crisis holdovers still bleed through to the universe of post-Crisis, not just in the continuity of the universe, but in the minds of the readers who grew up reading them and appreciated those characters and are kind of sad that they've faded out. Mm. So this is actually a celebration and an attempted streamlining of continuity by Morrison, and I think it works in that respect. I just don't think it works as a political polemic.
Yes, this is the first time that Grant Morrison really delves into that trying to make sense of the continuity, as you mentioned. Most notably, I forget the name of the character. He's in Arkham Asylum. He's a pirate.
Psycho pirate,
yes.
Have you read Crisis on Infinite Earths, by the way?
Yes, I have. I remember that at the end of it, he was the one character who still remembered the multiverse existed, or one, the most prominent one that they highlight.
He was meant to be the only one. Then other writers started screwing it up.
Yeah, of course. And I'm sure that when, what was his name, George Perez?
And Marv Wolfman, yes.
And Marv Wolfman. I'm sure that when they wrote that little cliffhanger in at the end, they weren't expecting it to be resolved in a really unknown character's first run with a British writer who'd just come over specifically for this. I'm sure they were probably expecting it to be sow the seeds for a larger multi-part storyline further down the line, something that was an event comic like Crisis was. But instead, Grant Morrison chooses to tackle it in here. And I must say, I was very disappointed with how he ends up tying up all of those loose ends, because it runs as an underlying story that crops up from maybe 2 to 3 issues. Every so often, you'll get a single page where Psycho Pirate is there talking about, oh, I can start to hear them. Can you hear them? I can see them starting to bleed through. And then there is one issue near the end that isn't really tied that much into the rest of the overarching plot of the narrative, where they go, oh, here you go, Psycho Pirate, because of his knowledge, it's bleeding through into the rest of reality, and he's seeing comic book pages, and the characters are starting to bleed back in, and they're going to take over or cause some kind of collapse of the universe. And then I forget exactly how they resolve that, but I remember it being very anticlimactic. I was sort of left sitting there with the comic going, oh, that's just done now. Oh, okay, Psycho Pirate doesn't matter anymore. That whole plot where they're all going to stream back into the universe and ruin everything or take back over, reestablish themselves, is done. There was the other character. I forget what his name is. John something, is it? The one who actually comes to visit Animal Man later on in the story.
I've got his name written down in my notes. I think it's Hazelwood, isn't it?
Yeah, they have the psychedelic trip together. He seems to be also experiencing that because the overarching theme that runs through most of the stories through this, the ones that aren't some of the most awful and heavy-handed political propaganda I've ever read in my entire life, is that there are multiple characters throughout the universe who are beginning to realize that they exist within a comic book universe and are starting to try and find ways to interact with the audience, the reader, that being us. There's a very famous page later on where Animal Man looks straight at you, the reader, and says, oh my God, I can see you, which is on its own very effective. I find it's a striking page. It's very effective. But I find that it all wraps up really anticlimactically. A lot of the overarching narratives in this wrap up anticlimactically to me. But we'll get into that more as we go into the plot mechanics.
Yeah, well, tell you what, I may as well slide this over to you so you can help refresh your memory as I go through
the history. It was around Christmas where I reread this. I read this when I was a teenager, and obviously being a teenager and never really experiencing meta storytelling before, I thought it was the coolest thing. Oh my God, they know they're in a comic book. This is like Deadpool, but 20 years earlier. Now I went back through it and I thought, oh, this is not as insightful or intelligent as it really desperately is trying to be.
Yeah, quite. And also, Joker knew he was in a comic book in the late 70s, so it's not a completely novel phenomena consigned to Deadpool, Harley Quinn, or Animal Man. But for a bit of background, Animal Man was created by writer Dave Wood and artist Carmine Infantino in 1965 in September's Strange Adventures 180. He was originally named A-Man just because of his costume. Mm-hmm. It was then changed to Animal Man in Strange Adventures 190, 10 issues later, nearly a year later. And he only appeared in 11 stories before Crisis on Infinite Earths. So during and after, presumably, Crisis on Infinite Earths before Grant Morrison's run, he was part of a group with the Immortal Man, who shows up later in there, Dolphin, one of the Sea Devils. So this obscure group of heroes who would fight Vandal Savage. And then Immortal Man sacrificed his life in the crisis and the group disbanded. And that was the only thing Animal Man was originally known for until Grant Morrison's run starting in 1988. So this was followed by Peter Milligan, Tom Veitch, Jamie Delano, the kinds of writers, some of whom came over from the British Invasion, who would go on to write Swamp Thing, Hellblazer, and other titles in the Vertigo imprint. And 6 issues into Jamie Delano's run, this series became Vertigo, but it is very much in the DC universe. Similar to Sandman, how it starts off in the first issue, it references Hawkman because Daniel Hall is related to Carter Hall, Hawkman. It references Batman, but as it goes on, it goes away from the DC universe and moves to a new imprint. And this volume of Animal Man, the first volume, ran for 89 issues and it also had an annual. Morrison wrote in this omnibus and in the run we're covering today, 28 issues. So we've got a fair bit to go through, but not every issue is particularly densely packed. And one Secret Origins issue where he wrote one story and they're explaining the contradictory origins of Animal Man. The art was provided by Chaz Trogg and Doug Hazelwood, and the covers famously also by British Invasion author Brian Boland.
Yeah, if there's one thing I can really give credit to this series for, it's that one, the covers are spectacular. Everybody knows that Brian Boland's cover art is gorgeous. And two, I actually really like the art of the interior comics as well. I think it's old-fashioned, very 80s, and I think it's... I like that aesthetic. I think it's very good where it's got the very differentiated, bright primary colors in it, and it's all very thick lines. There's not the sketchiness that you would get going into the 1990s where everything had to be cross-hatched to absolute hell.
Well, there's something later on when we get onto the meta issue that we've already presaged that foreshadows the transition from 80s to 90s art style that stops meta continuity being as possible. This is something, again, we discussed in issue 3. In the 80s, with artists like Dave Gibbons, who did a Green Lantern run and then went on to do Watchmen with Alan Moore, with Brian Boland in The Killing Joke, with Doug Hazelwood here, the gutter panels, the white space between panels, for those who aren't very familiar with comics, was very pronounced. Often they would have a set number of panels per page. This is the 9-panel grid you see from Watchmen. And so you can play with time because the panels themselves and the gutters denote time passing between each image. And Morrison plays with this concept in issue 5, Coyote Gospel, which I think is probably the best issue in this run. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the 90s, when it became constant splash pages, constant fights, constant action poses, and the writers were moved out for the artists, like the image creators like Rob Liefeld and Jim Lee, images became larger, but also more static, and you had less form of comics to play with. And that's why actually the writing took a major hit. And Animal Man in the issue with Psycho Pirate actually presages how, if you start erasing those panel distinctions, you start crowding too much into one page, which even George Perez did during his Wonder Woman run, to his fault, God rest him, you start to move away from comics as a form and constrict the amount of things that you can do playfully with a comic.
Yes, and I do think that that's been an issue that I noticed when I started to properly pick up comic books as a teenager, which is, as much as I really enjoyed the art, there is an artist such as J.H. Williams III, who I think his art is really striking. It's very unique. He's got a really special style that looks great. But because of the fact that every page has to be some kind of non-linear splash where you have a central image with panels thrown here and there, it's quite difficult to follow along which panel you're supposed to be reading when, and it can get a bit confusing and turn into a bit of visual noise. The clearness of this really helps. I really like, once again, how clean the pages are. I think that there are splash pages. I'm looking at one right now, but they're done at the opportune moment to increase the maximum effect. Oftentimes there's a crescendo to the end of a storyline that's being put through here. So I think the art is great. I don't really have much else to say about this other than the art is fantastic all the way through. Yep. And is one of the major highlights of this, especially how Hazelwood morphs Animal Man's appearance throughout the story, where early on he looks very bright, very happy, very young. He's full of hope and vigor, he is, but then by the end he has become this dark, beaten man who's just had so many tragedies heaped upon him and allowed himself. And this is one of the actual things that I do appreciate about the story, as heavy-handed as the propaganda can be, and we'll get into it, which is that Animal Man himself is not positively affected by his involvement in activism. His activism, his hands-on approach, where he will go and involve himself with people who are basically terrorists and don't care about hurting people, does affect him negatively. It weighs heavy on his mind, and it is something that is dwelled on throughout the story. Well, not throughout the story, towards the middle of the story. But then, again, I have to criticize that it then gets swept over very, very quickly when the meta-narrative of the story starts to take center stage, which... Yeah. And is interesting, which is that this is basically an activist comic book in some of the storylines that Morrison is putting forward. But the actual activist, I have a message for you stories take up a very short percentage of its overall runtime. There's only maybe 6 or 7 issues solo dedicated to talking about animal rights issues. You've got the first 4 issues. You have the monkey one, where they're going and rescuing monkeys who are being experimented on. You have the dolphin issue, and then you have the South Africa issue. Most of the rest of the story is entirely dedicated to Animal Man realizing that he's in a comic book.
You have a few obnoxious interjections, which I have pulled out, but yes, most of it is focusing on meta-narrative and household drama.
Yeah, because you have this big multi-issue story with the aliens who he discovers, who might be the people who created him. They might be some kind of middleman communication between the comic book writer and Animal Man himself. And he gets to see that there was a previous continuity that he was part of, a life that he didn't live but remembers somehow. You get the Coyote Gospel, which is a fantastic issue, I must admit. Then you get, later on, his family dying, and then him trying to figure out what. He finds out that it was all organized by some shady corporatists, but then once they're taken care of, he needs to find out why, what happened. He needs to try and go back in time to save his own children. and he doesn't, and ends up breaking through into the middle parts of reality, between reality, and eventually meets Grant Morrison, which at the time, I'm sure, was the biggest twist ever. Oh my God. But now, to me, honestly, comes across as a very self-indulgent way to insert yourself as the primary player of the DC universe, at least this little corner of the DC universe, and honestly wrap things up in a way that I found very lazy and, again, self-indulgent.
Well, if I can, before we go through the actual issues one by one, this is something Morrison is known for. You've read Final Crisis, correct?
Sadly, yes.
Yes. Okay, so Final Crisis, which I think we may have to cover at some point because it would just be hysterical.
Can I drop acid before I read it? Because Grant Morrison, I'm pretty certain, was on something when he was writing it.
He was on undiluted hate for editors. Final Crisis is actually a meta-narrative for how Grant Morrison refused to be edited and found it offensive to be edited. And I must say, he needed to be edited. But the reason I bring it up is because both Final Crisis and this are resolved by a deus ex machina. That is the title of the last issue of Animal Man, and it is the machine that Superman builds and sings a song that resonates throughout the multiverse in Final Crisis. And it seems that Grant allows these ideas, these metatextual ideas, to run away from him, and then realizes he has contradictions in the story that don't line up with his own thinking. For example, how animal rights activism can lead into terrorism. And then he just tells the reader to donate to PETA, who kill more dogs and animals they rescue than they actually save. This is a problem. So he needs to insert himself in, or a device in, that wraps up the story really quickly in the way that he has always envisioned it ending, but can't draw the connective tissue there. And I also reference it because the yellow aliens in this story that represent the disjunction in continuity pre and post crisis, and possibly liaise with Morrison as the writer, are also in Final Crisis with the monitors. And the monitors represent the editors who can't quite corral those 52 Earths into being static entities and being creative and not hem in the writers. And so he literally drives a stake through the heart of a vampiric editor, because the editors, let's just say Dan DiDio, only steal creativity from the writers and artists who are actually making the characters and are like draining the life essence from them. So we need the Green Lanterns to drive a stake through their heart. So Morrison, not known for his subtlety, about as subtle as a brick in a duck.
No. Well, that's the thing for me, which is that Grant Morrison is the victim of the progressive mentality, which is that of incredibly lofty ideals that you have to hold yourself to at all times, which are completely unattainable in real life. One of these ideals that he seems to be putting forward here is creativity without restriction. The problem with that is that creativity always needs restriction, whether it be time schedule, whether it be somebody else looking over your shoulder and saying, are you sure about that? One of the best that I've always heard, I forget who said it, was that writers should always have a five-year-old in their office asking them why. Whenever they write anything down, something happens in the script, why? Why? Because five-year-olds and toddlers, they love to ask you why. Because writers often will get lost within their own ambitions and let the story get away from themselves and just write a series of things happening with very thin connective tissue. And I think that that's partially what Grant Morrison did here. But yeah, he has these lofty ideals that he holds himself to. And he also is not as clever as he thinks he is as well. Because just writing a story where the guy finds out he's in a comic book, ooh, what happens? Oh, he finds the writer. And then the writer says, oh, writing comics is actually really hard because I have to stick to a schedule and come up with things on a week-to-week basis.
I love then how you became Alan Moore by default.
Well, he's an asshole as well.
oh yeah, writing comic books is hard. I hate having to come up with things on a time scale. Anyway, you know, I kind of feel like maybe this comic's a bit more miserable than I wanted it to be. So here you go, cheap happy ending. Also, I'm a lefty wanker, donate to PETA.
That's the ultimate, because there's a lot of visual metaphors as you get to near the end of this story, such as the monkey on the typewriter writing Shakespeare, which is actually quite an entertaining little panel. But I don't think it says as much as he says. It's a nice visual reference to the idea of, oh, infinite monkeys on infinite typewriters. And he's saying, I'm the monkey on the typewriter accidentally writing Shakespeare. But no, you're not, Grant. You're a hack comic book writer who's written a few interesting stories here and there. And because of the fact that you're a lefty wanker, you have been, and because you go like, ooh, comic books, wow, weird, isn't it? Loads of really pretentious, big for their boots comic book reviewers have held you up as this paragon of incredible comic writing, when really Grant's best work outside of Batman, which I actually really I might live to regret this. I remember really enjoying his run when I read it. I doubt it'll hold up as well as I remember it doing. But his best work tends to be on the really, really concise stories. Something like We Three, which puts across an animal rights message far more effectively than this does in three very tight issues. Whereas with this, once again, he just lets it get away with himself. And I'm not saying that you can't have meta-narratives. I'm a big fan of meta-narratives and storytelling. I know I always go on about it. My favorite TV series, Twin Peaks, acts as a meta-narrative, commenting on all sorts of different tropes and trends within television going from the early 90s to the mid-2010s. But it still is telling a story. And the story is what takes precedence over the meta-narrative. If you examine the flesh and the connective tissue, obscure as it can be, you can tell that the creators of that show had an idea of the rules that everything was following and a direction that it was all taking. Whereas with this, Grant Morrison literally throws out all of the rules at the end, purely so he can go, comic writing is hard, guys. And then all of the industry gives him a round of applause and says, whoa, write Doom Patrol next.
It is mad, actually.
And then he writes Doom Patrol, and Doom Patrol disappears even further up its own arse at one point. I remember reading Doom Patrol, and there was a few issues that I was reading when I was approaching 20, where I was just reading it. What the bloody hell is going on? Grant, I know you love drugs, Grant. I know you love drugs.
By his own admission, by the way.
But you need someone to stop you as you're about to take that next line and say, hold up, I think we're done here, Grant. Okay? It frustrates me. It frustrates me. It's too big for its boots.
I am both annoyed and impressed that Grant Morrison, essentially after being commissioned to turn this 4-issue limited series into a 28-run series, made money admitting that he didn't know what to write. That's the purposes of this.
Literally the last issue is Animal Man going, why did you make all these horrible things happen to me? And Grant Morrison go, it was kind of out of ideas, to be honest. Yeah. And a massive monologue complaining about how out of ideas he was the whole way through writing. Grant, I can tell.
it's also kind of a wizard battle with Alan Moore, which I will bring up later.
Okay, all right.
Also, for anyone who wants to read Animal Man and read some actually, as well, some very good Animal Man stories that aren't metatextual, he returned in 52, and that's when Grant Morrison decided to write him. That's not New 52, it's 52 following Infinite Crisis. Then he had a 6-issue limited series called The Last Days of Animal Man, which is fine. It's covers with Brian Boland. They look fantastic. And was rebooted in the New 52 as a horror series by Jeff Lemire, who wrote Sweet Tooth, and Steve Pugh, who'd also been an Animal Man writer. Very surrealist, fantastic horror comic, would recommend. So let's jump into the first 4 issues because they're very distinct to the other run. So issue 1 was released in September 1988. Animal Man was mentioning his intention to join the Justice League International. So I think this was originally conceived as a presaging series for an obscure character to then be folded into the very popular Justice League title that was splitting into Justice League America and Justice League Europe. If anyone's interested in Justice League International, we should cover it at some point. I'm gutted that Aidan Paladin will be coming back, but I'll be away because it's one of her favorite comics.
Is it really? Yeah. Oh, that's a shame.
So next time she's over, we'll have to get her on the panel to do it.
Can I say, though, even with this, there is the meta aspect creeping through here because Grant Morrison turns Animal Man into Grant Morrison. He is a complete self-insert with all of his high ideals and all of his struggling with, oh, I'm supposed to be protecting animals, but I eat animals. One of the first things that he does with the story is turn Animal Man into a vegetarian, if not a vegan. And Grant Morrison, in the course of writing this, decided that he was going to become a vegetarian. And even with that, he wants to join the Justice League International. That's part of the story, but you could also say that it's kind of a stand-in for what was happening with Grant Morrison going from being an obscure 2000 AD writer. I think the thing he was most known for before this was the comic book Zenith, which I read back in the day, and joining the Justice League International, that being the big American comic book industry and being part of DC, which is this enormous creature, something bigger than that he'd never been part of before. So I can see the metatextual aspects coming through even there.
Yeah, that's actually an important reading. I quite like that. One thing that is very distinct from Grant and Buddy, though, is that Buddy is married with kids. Grant Morrison doesn't have kids. Grant Morrison also is going by they, them pronouns.
Isn't he a drag queen now or something?
He always has been. To put Joker, go see our Arkham Asylum episode issue 2, he wants to put Joker in fishnets, stilettos, and a long black coat because he wanted him to dress up like Madonna. And they said Jack Nicholson did not want to be confused as a cigarette. Therefore, we can't release this in the same year as Batman 89, Grant.
I've got a stream of Jack Nicholson scenes where he's throwing slurs out running through my mind now, particularly that one from The Shining. You know the one.
In the Joker makeup as well. That'd be great. Joaquin Phoenix isn't the only one. So Animal Man focuses on the domestic drama with his wife, Ellen, his son, Cliff, and his daughter, Maxine. Cliff is 9. Maxine's a toddler. And it's one of the few superhero books that actually focuses on a family man with kids. So he has responsibilities just not to perpetually exist in the Justice League Watchtower and go on random excursions. Grant also carried this over in his Batman run, as I understand. So from issue 1, we established we're at least 8 years into the DC universe. So that means that Crisis happened a couple of years ago, about 5 years in, which is already starting to show certain contradictions.
It's a similar thing that happened with New 52, where Batman's only been around for 5 years, but he's somehow managed to build up this impressive array of connections and somehow go through 3 Robins.
Five Robins.
I don't remember that. What? Damian Wayne still existed. Dick Grayson, as well, yeah.
So Dick Grayson is somehow in his 30s, but also became Robin at 13, which was 5 years ago. Jason Todd died and was resurrected. We have Tim Drake, who was Robin, but also wasn't Robin, but Nightfall happened, so somehow, we don't know. We also had Stephanie Brown during War Games.
Oh, hell yeah.
And she has to have been Robin because she was part of Batman Incorporated, which Grant Morrison wrote, and then Damian Wayne.
To be fair, I think with Batman Incorporated, Grant Morrison got to play a bit of silly buggers around the editors because Grant Morrison, I think, turned around and said, listen, guys, I've been writing this story for 6 years now. If you tell me that I can't carry on the story after I've set everything up the way I wanted to, I am not going to be very happy. So I think they gave him a lot of leeway. There was a time where I think Grant Morrison held some incredible sway within the company. And I think it was after Batman and maybe one or two other... I think it was after Batman and his Superman New 52 run. He decided that he was going to move on to more independent comics companies.
Well, no, he's still working there now.
Is he still? I thought he just did
a 12-issue Green Lantern run, which was quite interesting. And then he did Superman and the Authority, which is like a boil on the arse of Superman's history, because Brian Bendis came in 2018. He aged up John Kent. Then John Kent was made gay by Tom Taylor and went on the School Climate Strikes as his boyfriend. And then so the plan was to send Superman into space on Warworld and then make Superman Injustice Superman. And Grant just said, no. What we're going to do is we're going to make him like Granddad Superman, looking similar to what he did in Kingdom Come, but to lead the Authority from Wildcats, with certain characters from the Elite, like Manchester Black. And then he also folded in OMAC, which is a Jack Kirby character, and made OMAC a transgender.
Oh, of course he did. Yeah. You know, like, throw back to my first ever segment with Lotus Eaters. They've comic book writers, they've always got that big red button, that big red gay button that they really just want to... Ah! We've lost all interest in the comic book characters. We've got no idea of where to take the story. Gay! Gay now! That's all that they want to do. That's really disappointing, honestly, because as much as I criticize Grant Morrison, he did write All-Star Superman, which is one of the defining texts of Superman since it came out in 2006, and the only success story that came from the very short-lived All-Star run that they were trying to do. Although we'll never lose Frank Miller. What are you, retarded? I'm goddamn Batman!
Making Robin eat rats and painting Green Lantern yellow.
No, painting himself yellow to ward off the Green Lantern's power while drinking a sip of lemonade.
And then having sex with Black Canary in front of Robin.
I can't believe he got Jim Lee to draw all of that for him. Do you think Jim Lee was like getting the scripts going, well, at least I'm getting paid for it.
How did I go from Hush to this?
Yeah.
Anyway, so speaking of insanity, so the first 4 issues focus on another obscure character called Bwana Beast, and he's looking to liberate chimpanzees from experiments to originally, the reason we're given, develop an AIDS cure in Star Labs. Star Labs being the main scientific and research group in the DC universe. The Flash has worked for them before. They created Cyborg and the like. And he accidentally fuses them all together in a sentient mass because he's been basically driven mad by animal suffering, because Bwana Beast's powers are he can drink this serum that makes him super muscular. And then he can also create animal chimeras. So for a bit of background that people don't know, he debuted in Showcase 66 in February 1967. His name's Michael Maxwell, and he survived a plane crash and drank some enchanted waters in a cave in Mount Kilimanjaro. And he is one of the only white Boana beasts. This also comes up later.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? In the South Africa issues, Grant Morrison turns around and is like, oh, by the way, Boana beast colonizer.
Yeah, quite.
Didn't actually care about Africa because he's white. Therefore, he can't care about Africa and all its animals. So we've got Black Boana Beast back, baby.
Yeah, so entirely undercuts his first four issues. But there you go. Thank Grant. So Buddy has just started to become a superhero. He has not quite got his costume right yet. He's still just stopped being a Hollywood stuntman. He's thinking about joining the Justice League Europe. He actually meets Superman in this issue, but it's a very fleeting introduction. Superman's shown to be a very congenial fellow, but he's so busy that Buddy just can't be included in the big leagues yet.
Early Grant Morrison, before what you said, always seemed to have a good read on Superman, where he was like, well, yeah, this guy, he's a really good guy, but he's also really busy because he kind of has to be everywhere at once because of the responsibility that comes with that power.
I think Grant's always had a good read on Superman. It's just the stories he puts Superman in, like Final Crisis or The Authority. The characters around Superman just kind of suck, so they drag the entire thing down.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.